says in Parshas Vayeshes, the Chassam Sofer has two questions. Number one, what does it mean that he made for his son a Ksonas Patim? Let me say, just very simply, he made for his son a little coat. I mean, isn't that what women do for, like, little kids when they're, like, so impressed they get them a piece of clothing? That's not something that a chush of a guy gets from his dad, who's a massive Talmud Chacham.
I was a little
17 years old. Don't argue about this point. This is an obvious point. At the age of 17, you give a kid a Ksonas Patim. Someone says, it's very
historical meaning, too.
I totally understand that it could have been that it was other Marishan's clothing. I understand. But the fact that it sounds like there was a reward given over to Yosef HaTzadik as getting this little cloak for him to be able to be his sort of like, here you go. Like, that's that. Why would his brothers be jealous of such a thing? Like, granted, again, if it's the clothes of other Marishan, that might be something. But the Ksonas Patim is something that you give. It's a simon given for a little boy. That's not all it was. It shouldn't be anything. And a more serious question is, how is Yaakov able to accept this Lashon Hara? How is he able to do that? Now, there are halachas regarding Neminal of Kibbeh Trey, and there are issues that are said regarding how he could have accepted Lashon Hara, but the Chassam Sof wants to take care of both. The fact is, Yosef was clearly a Talmid Chacham greater than all of his brothers. It was clear to everyone, including the Shvatim, which leads to a problem called Ayin Hara. To stop the Ayin Hara, Yaakov, you know, first of all, didn't think the Shvatim were capable of doing such a thing. They were great men. He didn't think that the Shvatim would ever have done an Ayin Hara over to Yosef. He never thought they were going to do it. But when he saw that Yosef started speaking Lashon Hara according to everybody else, when he saw that there was such Lashon Hara being told, then he was afraid there was a period between them. And once there was a period between them, then Yosef HaTzadik would have an Ayin Hara put upon him, to which Yaakov gave him a Ksonas Patim so that the other Shvatim wouldn't be jealous of. The whole point of the Ksonas Patim was to take away the Ayin Hara, not to give an Ayin Hara. It was like a cute little coat that's given over to somebody who's not cautious. That's the concept of it. The Ksonas Patim was something to be given, says the Chassam Sofer, and something where the Shvatim would be able to look at it and say, he's nothing. They belittled it. They thought it was an absolute nothing thing to give it over to him. It's the exact opposite effect of what the Shvatim would do. They would look at it and say, he's just nothing. But unfortunately, the Shvatim did take it the wrong way. They understood the Ksonas Patim as something that he was beyond the ordinary, right? And that the Shvatim weren't. That made them hate him and become jealous of him. And all because of that. It wasn't because of a little shirt. It wasn't because of that. But more because there was something that was going on that the Shvatim thought was behind the scenes. Now, you just asked about Ole Ayin, that Yosef HaTzadik didn't have an Ayin Hara. It could be that was more toward the end of his life, after he had made himself into somebody special. And that's when he was Ole Ayin and Yaakov Avinu saw that. But not up until that point. Up until that point, there still could be an Ayin Hara. But that's an amazing Chassam Sofer. An amazing Chassam Sofer that just tells you. And that really the Ksonas Patim was supposed to be the opposite effect. That it was never there to make a person special. It was just like a little piece of clothing, like a little nice thing that a mommy gives over to a child to make him feel like he's special. And that's that. And Yaakov did it on purpose to get the Shvatim away from him. Okay, but Yaakov Kamenetsky says that when it says the line by Yosef HaTzadik, that hu nar, right, that everything that was going on with him, it says that hu roa esechov, that he was a shepherd together with all of his brothers, right? And that's what it was supposed to be. There's something about Yosef that was a little bit different. The exact wording of the pasuk is Hayah ro'eh esachav batzon. He shepherded, seemingly, with his brothers by the sheep. Now, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, from a daik in the pasuk, it sounds like Hayah ro'eh. He was the ultimate shepherd, meaning he was the shepherd put in charge of all the other shvatim because he was the smartest when it came to where to graze and where not to graze, where to bring the sheep and where not to bring the sheep, and that's why Yosef HaTzadik was put in charge of everybody else. That's what he ended up doing. He told the Shvatim what to do, and his dreams were Mora on that point. His dreams were showing everybody that I am the one who's going to be in charge, just like I'm in charge now, and I'm telling you what to do. So do you, later on in life, I'm going to be the person in charge, I'm going to be the king. Later on, they decided to rebel against them, and that's why they said, "Vayelchu echov liros es tzon avihem b'shchem," that the brothers went to shepherd their own sheep, the sheep of their father, in Shchem. Liros es tzon, there's a little dot on top of the aleph and the tuf by s. Rashi says, "Liros es atzmon," to graze themselves. You know what the pshat is? What Rashi is trying to hint to is that they were trying to do themselves. They were trying to go away from Yosef. They said, Yosef is going to tell us what to do. We're going to do what we want to do. We're going to do whatever we want to to do, and we're going to make our sheep graze wherever we want. Ve'emar Saul Yosef, Yaakov even said to Yosef, Halo achecha roim b'Shechem, aren't your brothers in Shechem? What's going on here? Did you tell them to go to Shechem? You're the one in charge, Yosef. What happened to you? Why would you tell them to go to Shechem? L'chovesh l'chacha aleihem. Go, I'm going to send you to them. Since you're the leader, you're going to have to tell them to go away from there. That's the pshat. It was really in shock. You're the leader, Yosef. How could you have allowed them to do such a thing? But they had rebelled. They went even further. They went to a city called Dothan, to not even go to Shechem, to go into a further city. And they thought, when they saw him coming, they thought he was coming to punish them for going against his wishes. And that's when they said, Hine, Balak Alomos Alozebo, that this guy who had all these dreams, who thinks he's in charge of us, he thinks he can rule over us, he's the one coming after him. Now, they already had Paskins, he's a Rodes. They mamish thought that he was trying to kill them. In some way, shape, or form, that was the Lashon Hara, that was the other thing. Things that he said, they mamish paskin that he was a rodent, and therefore he was chayv misa. Here it's even more so. We're going to rebel against his rulership, that we're going to have Yehuda as our leader, or maybe even Reuven, but we're not going to have Yosef. That's not going to happen. Yeah.
Well, Yaakov, I was a very smart person. Why would he put a 17-year-old son in charge of his sons were like 27, 28?
23. I mean, he was only 6 years younger than Reuven, if that. Yeah, because remember, during the first 7 years he worked, the next 7 years was when he was married to Leah and Rachel.
Right.
Reuven was born in the first year, and Yosef was born in the seventh year. And that's when they left. So he was, at best, 6.5 years, probably less than that, younger than Reuven. So the question is, so why would Yosef been in charge? The answer is that Yosef was the one who had the chokmah for
this. Where did you see that? That was so jealousy and his older brother.
So they tried saying he's a ben zekunim. You know, he was from Rachel Imenu. In that sense, he thought that the shvatim would be okay with him. Remember, we're not dealing with regular people.
Right.
We're dealing with shvatim to which he thought that the shivteka would understand such a thing. But there was more to it. With the Lashon Hara, with the dreams, there was more to it that Yaakov Avinu knew, but never thought that anything like this could have ever happened. And that, but let's be honest with ourselves. I don't think anybody would ever expect their kids to do anything like this. Anybody would expect it.
Okay.
Now, granted, there was a chiyuv misa involved, and that they had paskin lahalacha that he was a rodent and then he was chayv misa. But I think that's part of it. Yosef Yaakov Avinu had never imagined. Now let's think about that for a second. Now, how could they have thrown him into a pit full of snakes and scorpions? Reuven tried to save Yosef from their hands, and they throw him into a pit full of snakes and scorpions. How would you do such a thing? Obviously, the snakes and scorpions are going to kill him. How in the world would you throw him inside? And it's possible they never knew what was inside there. Because let's think for a second. You throw a kid into a pit filled with snakes and scorpions, and he doesn't die. I mean, come on. You don't think that you would pull him out of there and be like, oh my gosh, a massive miracle just happened? There's no way we can sell him down to Mitzrayim? They must not have known that there were snakes and scorpions inside that pit. They must not have had any idea what was going on inside that pit. And the kasha is, how did they not know? How didn't they know? Why couldn't they just look inside the pit and see what was inside this? The Chassam Sofer says.
Is it Pshat in the Pesukim? That
was
scorpions and
there were snakes and scorpions. The way the line we all know from the Hanukkah Gemara is right.
In mind.
I'm sorry.
In general, snakes and scorpions just hang out in the open.
No, they'll hang out in the pit.
Yeah, but they're really, even in the pit, they're underneath rocks.
I would assume they're around there. But even so, you'd think you'd check such a thing before you throw them in, especially if it was filled with snakes and scorpions, as the Gemara says.
Cool.
Filled. So meaning it's completely filled. There's more than just one snake and scorpion inside there. There was a bunch inside there. You'd think you wouldn't have done such a thing, but listen to this.
Water.
I'm sorry? No, in Mayim, right? A bore rake in Bo Mayim. So they knew there was no water inside. But here's the pshat. They understood something from him. Here's what it was. Why did they throw him into this pit? Okay, says the Chassam Sofer, this pit was 12 pits deep. How big does a pit have to be in order to kill somebody? From the Gemara and Bava Kama, guys. Not four amos. Ten tefachim altogether. Okay, this pit was 12 pits deep. That means that it was 12 pits of 10 tefachim each. 12 times 10 is 120 tefachim. How many tefachim are there in an amma?
5 or 6.
6. Let's go with 6, that's the normal amount. 6 tefachim in an amma. If you have 120 tefachim, divide that by 6. 120 tefachim, divide by 6, what do you have?
20.
You got 20 altogether. 20 amos was the size of this pit. Okay? 20 amos, says the Gemara, is the amount of space that it takes to lo shota ba'ena. The eye of a person is not able to see it. That's what we learn from Sukkah, Bezim, and Aleph. And thus, they were not able to see what was going on 20 amos down in the pit. They could see there was no water in there because they'd be able to see the water raise above that amount. But the snakes and the scorpions were too far down. It was such a deep pit that it went so far down that they had no idea that there were snakes and scorpions in there. It was lo shota ba'ena because it was 20 amos deep. Why would he throw him into such a pit? Because he went against and he had sinned against the Shvatim. So he went 10 tefachim for every shevet that he had sinned against, although it, technically that went for him himself. 10 times 12 is 120, and that was the 120 tefach pit. That's why Reuben picked exactly this pit that was 120 tefachim deep. That's why he threw him specifically in this pit no matter what. You know what's unbelievable? That explains the juxtaposition, meaning in the best art scroll word that there could possibly be. In the Gemara in Shabbos, it says in the Chanukah Gemara, by the Gemara in Shabbos, that if a Chanukah licht is over 20 amos, you have to take it down. Why? Lo shota ba'ena. You can't see it when it's 20 amos tall. And right next to it says, Habor Reik Ein Bo Mayim, both drushes from Rebbe Tanchum. Habor Reik Ein Bo Mayim, there was no water in it, but Nechashim Ba'krabim Yeshbo, there were snakes and scorpions. The Gemara is trying to answer the question, why would the Shvatim have thrown him in a pit that had snakes and scorpions in it? Why would you do such a thing? The answer is, they didn't know there were snakes and scorpions in the pit. How couldn't they see it? Because it was 20 amos deep. And if it was 20 amos deep, you can't see that far like we see by the Hanukkah licht, and that's why they were able to throw them in thinking that there was nothing inside there. That's the pshat behind the Gemara putting the two together. Yeah, yeah.
How many feet is that?
How many feet? Pronounce about let's say in amos a foot and a half, so give or take. Chazanish is about 1.78.
If you throw 30 feet down a hole, then they just went down there and
could it be they lowered him with a rope? I would assume that would be the easiest, that they lowered him down with a rope.
They're just to kill them. They're not going to lower him with a rope.
The point was not. Remember, let's go in the beginning. Remember, Yosef was supposed to be killed, and Reuben got up and tried to save him by throwing him in the pit. That's what he had said. Let's throw him in the pit instead. Right? But the question is, if you're trying to save him, don't throw him in a pit where he could be killed. That's not the right thing, so it must be that they didn't know there were snakes and scorpions in that pit. How did they not know? Because it was too deep. What is too deep? 20 amos from the Gemara in Chanukah, and thus we see that that's what they threw him into, and that's the shot behind this.
We're going to lower you into this pit so we can get out.
Pretty much. That was it. And then eventually we know what happened with Yehuda. That Yehuda said, let's sell him down to Mitzrayim. Instead of leaving him in the pit until he dies, let's sell him down to Mitzrayim. That's what ended up happening. Remember, they also wanted to bring him to a place where Yaakov would never find the body. That was also part of the problem. They wanted to make sure that Yaakov would never find the body. But that was that in itself. Now, in the middle of the parsha, after Yosef HaTzadik is sold, before he goes down to Potiphar, we're not going to talk about Potiphar and everything that happened with his wife and everything. That's not for today. But there's something that happens with Yehuda. And it's a very, very strange story. Yehuda goes down from his position with his brothers. The brothers blamed him for selling Yosef down to Mitzrayim and not bringing him back to his father. The brothers blamed him. He went down and he married a Canaanite woman. Okay? So you have to say that Shua, who is the name of his father-in-law, must have been a chush of a guy. And his daughter was like a chush of a girl. You gotta say something like that, because otherwise, how could you marry a Canaanite? Rashi says it was a merchant. Okay, there, but like, who would he marry? What is that? Give her to a child by the name of Er. Give her to another child by the name of Onan. Give her to a third child by the name of Shelah. Okay, three children altogether. It says, Er was the Bechor of Yehuda. He was evil in the eyes of Hashem. Vayimiseihu Hashem, he was killed. After he had married the woman Tamar, he was killed. It does not say what he did, but Rashi tells us that he didn't want to destroy Tamar's beauty. So instead of being together with her in a normal way, he did something terrible. He had Shechlad Dor Levachala, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu killed him. Yehuda said to Onan, Bo el Eishes Achicha V'yabim Osa. It's time for you to do Yibum. A parsha in the Torah of Yibum to marry the brother who passes away, his wife.
Well, they have Yibum, but they don't have yet to marry a Jewish woman?
There's no such thing.
So why
who are you going to marry? Who are you going to marry?
Maybe they come to her.
Who are you going to marry? I understand,
but for sure, it's Kanani's woman. That's ushered before her because Avram.
Granted, and that's why I said it was a merchant, not a Kanani. So you got to say that. But again, yes, you're right. But who are you going to marry? That was the part of the problem. Yehuda said to Onan, yes, Mishama she was Megayer. You'd have to assume that she was Megayer. But Vyoma Yehuda Laonan, Yehuda said to Onan, Bolish Lachicha Biyadon, so do evil. Mahakim Zer Lachicha, and establish children for your brother. Vayeda Onan ki lo lo yeazara. He knew that the child would not be his. What in the world does that mean? Vayeda, if he's together with the wife of his brother, the Shechai Sarza, again, he was had Zera, put it on the ground, levilting his son Zera Lachib so that he would not allow children to be there for his brother. Vayeda ben Hashem, that was evil in the eyes of God, Asher also the Yamas Gamoso, he was killed as well. Why does it say what Onan did, but it doesn't say what Er did? Er did the exact same thing. It says Vayomes Gama Oso, also him. Why didn't it say that by Er? Was Onan any worse? Onan was worse than Er. Why would Er started it?
He also just cursed his brother.
Okay, so that's good. That's good. But the sin itself should have been written by Er the same way it's written by Onan. And then it says, "Vayomer Yehuda l'Tamar, sit there for a little bit until Shelah grows up." She stopped. She couldn't wait anymore. She obviously went to the crossroads, met up with Yehuda, slept with Yehuda, had two children, Peretz and Zarah. Strange muscle. Let's first see. Tamar might have been the grandson of Shem. Might have been. We don't know exactly. We don't see exactly what Er did to have died. Onan, it says it's straight out, but it's clear it's something. But it's weird, because by Yomez Gamoso, he was killed seemingly for the same death, but no way it was the same death. Onan did what he did, because he didn't want to allow his brother to have children. Er did what he did, because he didn't want to ruin her beauty. Er is, I would think, is worse than Onan. Er did something that was crazy. Onan did something because he was upset at his brother.
Something that's rational. Onan is doing something just despite his brother, which is
a rational is people. You get married. I understand. It's not about the beauty.
No, I'm saying no. But there's a logic behind what he was doing, right or wrong. I mean, obviously wrong. But then Onan was doing it, not only was doing it something wrong, he was doing it to spite
his brother. Yeah. Not a bad call. Yeah. So even more so. So what's the gamoso? What does that mean that Onan died seemingly in the same death as Er? He wasn't. It was a different death. It was something different. So what is that? So we know there's a concept of chut ha-meshulash. The chut ha-meshulash lo yinatek. If you have three strings put together, they will never break. And the concept is, if you have a grandfather, a father, and a son that all learn in the same way, if they're all in the same vein, then once you have the chut ha-meshulash lo yinatek, then nothing bad will happen to the children. Now, in this case, you have more than a chut ha-meshulash. You have Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Yehuda, who all were great, great tzaddikim. Okay, all of them were absolutely great tzaddikim. Er was born. And Er knew there was nothing he could do to get rid of that. He was always going to have that tzidkus inside him. He was always going to have that ability to become a great man, and that got Er upset, says Chasam Sofer. He hated the deeds of his forefathers. He was a bad person to begin with, and he wanted his child to decide for himself what to do without having that spiritual DNA from the shvatim, from his forefathers within it. And that's the pshat. He was mashchis his zera, not allowing Tamar to have a child, because similar to Onan, he knew the children wouldn't be his. Onan said, I don't want the children to be my father's. And Er said the same thing. I don't want the child to be like my father's. That's what he was. But you know what's worse, says Chasam Sofer in a parenthesis? You know what's worse? Someone who has his kids, who has the kids anyway, he ends up having the kids anyway, and then teaches them Sfarim of the Minin, the apostates, and other Tomei things that destroy their minds. That's even worse, says Chasam Sofer. But even so, Er did not want to have a child that was going to be automatically predestined, preordained to be like the others. To that he said, I don't want to have such a child, and that's what made him similar. Okay, so good, we got Er right now, right? But still, we got a lot of problems with this story. What's going on here with Yehuda and Tamar? Some of the clear, the strangest things is all. And we know this is Min HaShamayim. It's clear it's Min HaShamayim. The Medrash says in Samach Pei Hei Sif Aleph, I don't even know what you call it, the Pisgah Aleph, within the Medrash it says, the Shvatim were in the midst of selling Yosef. Reuven was in the midst of doing tshuva. Yehuda was in the midst of getting married. And Hashem was in the midst of bringing about the Or of Mashiach. He's trying to bring about Mashiach. At that point, when everybody's going around, So it's clearly everything here is going min hashamayim. What's pshat? What happened over here? Now let me ask you six questions. Number one, throughout the Torah it seems, says Rabbi Yaakov, the mother names the child. You see quite often that the mother is the one that's calling the name by the child, especially by the Shvatim. Especially by the Shvatim. There is only one, no, Rachel named them, and Yaakov changed it, switched it just a little
bit. That's the name we use.
You're right. But it was very close. Benoni and Binyamin. Benoni and Binyamin. But there is something that's right there.
The father has the veto power, apparently.
Apparently. Yehuda names Peretz and Zerach. Yaakov names Levi. Why? Why did Yehuda have to get so involved in all of those names? Now, it says by Er, Vayikra as Shmo Er, Yehuda called his son's name Er. Vatikra as Shmo Onan. She called the name Onan. Vatikra as Shmo Shelah. She called the name Shelah. And by Peretz and Zerah, he named them. Why did he get number 1, 4, and 5, and he didn't get 2 and 3? That's the question number 1 that we have over here. And why did Yaakov name Levi, but he didn't name the others? That's question number 1. Number 2, the Torah tells us the sin of Onan, but it doesn't really go into what happened with Er. It seems that they both have the exact same thing, right? But it doesn't say anything. What was going on with Er and Onan exactly? What exactly was Onan worried about when he wouldn't marry Er's child, so to speak? What happened? Number 3. Why do we have to know that Yehuda, when he was on his way and Tamar caught him at the crossroads, that he was on the way to shear his sheep? I understand there was a holiday back then, but what's the big deal that we have to know he was on his way to shear his sheep while he was going, and that's when Tamar caught him? What exactly did that mean? Number 4, why didn't he give her over to Shelah? What was he worried about? What happened with Shelah exactly that he didn't give her over? So they say he was too young. I understand that. Is there another answer as to why he wasn't? Was he really worried about what was going to happen? And why didn't he tell her what he was worried about? Why not say to her, here's what I'm worried about. I'm worried about Shelah. Number 4. Number 5, it seems it was very important to know who was the firstborn by Tamar's kids. Who cares? Like Peretz and Zerach. Zerach got that little string that was tied around his hands to show that he had put his hand through first, and then he came out, and the Peretz came through, and he's like, wow, you broke your way through, Peretz. Wow, unbelievable. Why do we care which order the children were born in? Does it make any difference in the world? They're not Bechors. They're not firstborns. Maybe there's a difference for Pidyon Petra Bechor, for the firstborn, you have to redeem your firstborn. How in the, they weren't redeeming firstborns back then. It's before Mitzrayim. Pidyon Petra Bechor seems to be clear it's from Mitzrayim. And anyway, it's still a strange thing. What in the world does that mean? And number 6, Divrei Hayamim was written in order to understand the Yichus of David HaMelech. So why in the world in Divrei Hayamim in the Perek Beis Pasuk Gimel does it say that Tamar was the daughter-in-law of Yehuda and Yehuda married his daughter-in-law? Doesn't sound very good for David, does it? And then it goes through Er, who died, and then Peretz and Zerach were born. Why not say that Onan died? Why doesn't it mention anything about Onan? Okay, to answer these questions, you need two akdamas, two introductions. Number 1, normally it was the mothers who named their children. There was only one exception, the Bechor. The person who took over the father's household was always named by the father. The person who took over the household and would be the man who took over what the father used to do. That man was always, always brought up to be the leader of the family, and that was named by the father through his Ruach HaKodesh and not through the mother. Otherwise, it was named by the mother. Yaakov ended up naming Levi, since he, Levi, was the one who was going to be the Rosh Hashiva. He was going to take over for his father. Not Reuven, not Shimon, although Yehuda was the king. He wouldn't be king during that lifetime. Levi was going to be the Rosh Hashiva after Yaakov, you know, and therefore Levi was named by Yaakov. Now we have to understand why Yehuda was naming. Now we understand why Er was named by Yehuda. Er was the Bechor. Sheila and Onan were not, so they were named by the woman. Says Rabbi Yaakov, that's the first name of Yaakov.
Wait,
number 2, yeah.
But Sarah didn't name like Yitzchak. I mean, Sarah named Yitzchak.
That might be different because like there was Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah involved in naming Yitzchak. Kol Shema Yitzchak Li, and that's the reason why. So Yitzchak was already named by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Avram Avinu beforehand. Number 2, the parasha of Yibum is very confusing. Okay, it seems the mitzvah is to call the newborn baby from this relationship after the deceased brother. Yakum al Shem Achiv. He gets established on the name of his brother. Seemingly you gotta call him whatever the brother's name was that died, that's the name you gotta call him. But the Gemara in Daf Chaf Dalet and Yevamis says that's not true. You don't have to name after the brother. There's no chiyuv at all to name after the brother. It's not there. Rather, we learn from that pasuk that the mitzvah is on the oldest son. The mitzvah is on the oldest son. I ask you very quickly. I don't get it. If it's on the same, it's only to name it. You know, it's not to name the brother whatsoever. It's only to pick the next guy in line to go ahead and do it. Why call it Yaakov al Shem Achiv? Why are you calling it that lashon? Sounds like you have to name the child after that. What's the pshat? Why would you do that? Says Rabbi Yaakov, it's possible that Yibum was a little bit different back then. Yibum always existed even before the Torah gave it as a mitzvah. Clearly, because Yehuda mentions it to Onan. It says, Yabe Mosa, I want you to do Yibum to her, which clearly means that it existed and was something of a mitzvah before the Torah ever gave it as a mitzvah. Maybe the mitzvah at the time of the Avos was a little bit different. At the time where we have it, Yibum is a bit of a choke. We don't really understand what exactly it does. But at the time back then, the point was to establish the brother as he was beforehand. And whatever he was, the new child that would be born would take his place. Fill the void left by the deceased brother. That means, says Rav Yaakov, the mitzvah of Yibum was more on the father than it was on the brothers back in the day. Meaning, if the father had a son that died, then he should do Yibum on his daughter-in-law. And he has the chiyuv to redo, so to speak, his son and make a brand new son to take the place of that son.
Assuming the mother is still alive and capable of bearing children, would you do Yibum first with your wife so you get another
son? So, that's that. Really, Yehuda was required to marry Tamar. He should have married Tamar and done Yibum because that child was going to take the place of the son who died. Who died? Heir. What was the status of heir? He was a Bechor. Which meant the child that was to be born instead of heir would take the place of heir and he would be the brand new Bechor. Even though Onan and Shelah were born before him, the new child would take the place of heir. He would be Yaakov al Shem Achiv. He would take over the fame, whatever it was that his brother was. That would be for him. That would be the new son. Interestingly, he would take over all the dinu of the mace. He would literally be the Bechor, and that means that's the translation of the word Yaakov al Shem Achiv. Not for now, because that pasuk doesn't really establish for us now, that's not what you do, but back in the day before the Torah was given, that's what it was like. There's only a few exceptions. The father cannot marry his daughter-in-law, okay? Cannot marry his daughter-in-law if he was sick, dead, obviously, or if he was already married. If he was already married, then the chiyuv went to the next person in line, that if the father won't do it, then it goes to the brother of the deceased. Brother of the deceased. But if the brother of the deceased marries her, he still can give birth to the Bechor of the family. You hear what I'm saying? Yehuda had a Bechor heir. Heir married Tamar, he was the Bechor. When he died, Yehuda should have married Tamar, but he didn't want to because he was already married to the daughter of Shua. So who's next in line? Onan. When Onan gave birth to a child with Tamar, that child would have had the status of the firstborn. So Onan refused to be together with her because what would happen if he was together with her? He knew that the child would not be his. It would be his father's. And that child would take over the Bechor, which meant that he wouldn't be the head of the family anymore. The head of the family would be his own kid, and Onan didn't want that. That's what it meant over here. Onan realized that it would be his father's and not him. He wanted to keep his position, which was right now to be the head of the family, the eldest in the family. He sinned, died, and now Shelah was in line to make the Bechor. Shelah was going to marry Tamar, give birth to the Bechor, and that Bechor would now be there. Yehuda said, I'm not ready. Why wasn't he ready? Yehuda's wife died. Now that Yehuda's wife died,
he didn't die until after he told her.
Until after he told her, hold on a second, wait for Shelah. Still thought that Shelah was still young, that's definitely there. But then all of a sudden his wife died. Which means who's back in line to be the first to marry Tamar? Yehuda's back. So now Yehuda was planning on marrying Tamar. The problem was, it came right in the midst of a holiday, which was during the time when he was shearing his sheep. So instead of going straight to Tamar and saying, I'm going to marry you, he went to go shear his sheep and have this holiday and go through everything. Tamar didn't realize the calendar of Yehuda, thinking that Yehuda was trying to shirk his responsibility of trying to do Yibum with her. So Tamar took things into her own hands and forced forced Yehuda's hand by being together with her. She said out loud, I'm single. I'm a Jewish woman. I'm a Gioris. I don't believe in Avodah Zarah. She said all the correct lines, says the Gemara, and so to Yehuda to tell him, I'm ready to go get married. And Yehuda understood something. But Yehuda was always planning on marrying Tamar only afterward, after he had come back and got fooled into this position.
What is Yehuda thinking then? If he was planning on marrying Tamar, and yet he was with this...
This woman. Was, at best, some form of a kedushin, which possibly could have led him into, okay, so of Sheila to marry Tamar, or to say to himself, there's something obviously mina shamayim about this girl, realizing that he had a taiva for her, even though he couldn't see her face, realizing that she was saying that she was Jewish, that she was a pnuya, that she was whatever it was, there was something off. You would have said, obviously HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me to marry this person instead of Tamar. So Tamar can still do yivam with Sheila. That'll be fine. My bechor will be from Tamar and Sheila.
Knocks out what you said before, that Yehuda has every intention of doing evil.
He did. Up until he saw that there was something mina shamayim.
And you shirk your responsibility of doing evil.
Yes. Meaning, yes. In that case, yeah, because it wasn't the same chiyuv as we have from the Torah today. And that's why we speak about this in Divrei Hayamim. It's a praise that Peretz was really born through a mitzvah of yibum. Because he took over for his son and became his own daughter-in-law, etc., thus becoming the Bechor of the family. And that's why we don't mention Onan anywhere, because he's not needed to define the Bechor status, and thus the Yichus of David. That's going to be the Yichus of David. That's why it's so important to know, very simply, who is the Bechor of Tamar. That's why it was so important. And they're going crazy. The woman was so nervous. Who's going to be the Bechor of Tamar? Because the Bechor of Tamar would take over the status of heir, and whoever would take over the status of heir would be the Bechor of Yehuda, and that Bechor of Yehuda would be the progenitor of Mashiach. That's why it was so important. They all wanted to know. They wanted to figure out who it was, and when Peretz took over, they realized even though he was the fourth son born to Yehuda, he took over for heir. That's why in Divrei Hayamim it goes to the children of Peretz, then it goes to the children of Sheila, then it goes to the children of Zerach. Because Peretz took over for Er, he was the Bechor. Sheila was the next in line, the second born, so to speak, the third born really, and Zerach was the fifth born. Really he counts as the third born in this case, because Aaron Onan died. That's why it goes through that order specifically. There's also a hint here to what's going to happen when Mashiach comes. First, there will be a shine that seems to be that Mashiach's going to come out, that Zerach. There will be like a shine. But then the arm goes back, and all of a sudden Mashiach will burst his way through from nowhere when nobody expects it. Some people will be busy doing tshuva, some people will be busy doing other things, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring about Mashiach in the craziest way. And that's the concept of what we're looking for in this parsha, guys. That's the idea of what we have over here. On top of that, have a good Shabbos.